Kurz. I am a member of the program committee and a pretty regular speaker. I've been a member of Prairie since 2002. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, though we recognize that we all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. During our virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. We'll also have joys and concerns at that time and then break into small groups for more discussion and chatting. We do have a few announcements that are in the order of service that was emailed to Prairie News, but I have a few things here. We're sharing our offering this quarter with Wilma's Fund, and there's a link to give on the order of service or go to the Prairie website and click give. Monday at 7 p.m. is Prairie's study group. We're discussing Breathe, A Letter to My Sons by Imani Perry. And even if you were not at the previous session, you're welcome to attend. Thursday fun night at 6:30 is for everyone. Advanced Virtual Dungeons and Dragons is Friday and Beginner is Saturday. On Sunday, April 18th at 10 a.m., we'll have two options. One will be an active one, trash pickup around the neighborhood. We've been assured there's plenty of trash to pick up. The other is a virtual service from the UUA called Side with Love. And there's more information in the order of service. And then I wanted to maybe call on Rachel. Did you want to say anything, Rachel, about the letter that was sent out and then the small correction?
Yes. Thanks for calling attention to that. And so I have any of you actually received the letter yet with the consent forms? I think the U.S. mail takes so much longer than it used to. Robin says she got hers. Robin, you are special. So after Robin received her letter, then I put out a correction that Robin had called my attention to. And so that I sent that on Prairie News and then found out that most people hadn't received their letter. So the letter is specifically describing our plans for reopening to outdoor services. And it has consent forms that we're asking you to sign in order to participate in those services. So the letter will explain everything. And the consent forms are on our website also, the correction that Robin pointed out, I'm asking you to add into your consent form before you sign it, and it will become clear when you look at the letter, but I also sent out a Prairie News saying the little phrase that I want you to write in. So I won't belabor the point, but just watch for your letter, and then if you have any question about the little insert, you can give me a call, but that went out on Prairie News.
Yeah, and there are two different things to sign. One is a waiver that we will not hold Prairie responsible if anyone should become sick after being there for whatever reason. And the other one is agreement to the various steps that we're all required to take to make sure everything's safe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And thank you for doing all that. Just a second. Just a moment, we'll have our chalice lighting. If you have a chalice at home, feel free to light that. Put this in the right place. Not high enough, all right. And we'll have a moment of silent meditation that will be started and ended with a chime. In our words to accompany the chalice lighting from Elizabeth Blackwell, none of us can know what we are capable of until we are tested. We have a story for all ages that Renee will show us.
I want to be a doctor. We are at the hospital. My mom and dad, my brother, Jack, and me. Jack is not so happy. His foot hurts a lot. I saw the whole thing. Jack flew off the top bunk. Maybe he forgot he can't fly. Dad put ice on Jack's foot. His foot is black and blue. Mom thinks it could be broken. So here we are in the emergency room. It is a busy place. Some people are hurt. Some people are sick. It is a good thing doctors are here to help. I like to help people too, I tell the doctor. Her name is Dr. Tate. Maybe you will be a doctor someday, she says. Dr. Tate looks at Jack's foot. She touches it gently. Let's take an x-ray, she says. It will show us if any bones are broken. We go to another part of the hospital. An x-ray machine takes a picture of Jack's foot. A man comes to look at the x-ray. Are you a doctor too, I ask. Yes, he says, I am Dr. Dean. I read x-rays. The doctor sees a small break in one of Jack's bones. So we go to see Dr. Jones, a bone doctor. There are doctors just for bones, I ask. Yes, Dr. Jones says, just like there are heart doctors, brain doctors, and skin doctors. Who do you see to get those glasses? Dr. Jones asks. The eye doctor, I say. What do you call your tooth doctor? Dr. Jones asks. The dentist, I say. And who do you see for checkups? He asks. My regular doctor, I say. Oh, I get it. She's a kid doctor. Mom and Jack go into the exam room. Dad and I decide to get a snack. In the cafeteria, we see lots of doctors and nurses on their lunch breaks. Dr. Tate is one of them. I used to think there was only one kind of doctor, I tell Dr. Tate, but there are so many kinds. What kind would you be? Dr. Tate asks. I shrug. Well, would you like to meet a few more? She asks. Dr. Tate takes us around the hospital. We meet Dr. Liu, who is a baby doctor. I've always loved working with little ones, Dr. Liu says. Then we meet Dr. Kent. He helps people walk again after an injury. I really get to know the people I treat, Dr. Kent says. Some of them I see every day. We meet Dr. Lopez, who works in a lab. She does tests to see what is making someone sick. You must like puzzles, I say. Yes, Dr. Lopez says, our work is like solving mysteries. I ask Dr. Tate what she likes about being an emergency room doctor. I meet so many people, she says. Every day is different and busy. Later we go find Mom and Jack. Jack has on a special boot. He needs to wear it for a few weeks. It will help his bone heal. Jack can even walk with it. He is feeling so much better. All thanks to doctors. Meet the doctors. Emergency room doctor, a doctor who works in the emergency room of the hospital.
All right, thank you. All right, and I'm going to share my screen. The presentation today relates to our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Well, in some of my presentations, I've gone a bit beyond the official UUs to talk about women who were free thinkers of various stripes, but today I'm squarely back in the UU world with a woman who specifically chose to be a Unitarian. Just as she chose her unconventional career. Elizabeth Blackwell had been on my list for a while as someone who'd be interesting to learn more about. So a new general interest book came out this year. That book is The Doctors Blackwell, How Two Pioneering Sisters Brought Medicine to Women and Women to Medicine by Janice Nimura. And I'll put that information in the chat after I'm done. It just came out this year. I got it from A Room of One's Own, but it's available wherever you get books. It's very readable and it presents Elizabeth and Emily in all their contradictions. For instance, Elizabeth broke numerous barriers for women, but she dismissed women's suffrage. Nomura starts her biography with the unveiling of a plaque in 2018 in Greenwich Village. This plaque marks the spot of the first hospital designed for, run by, and staffed by women. And that's what this plaque says. In this building, the site of Elizabeth Blackwell's infirmary for women and children, the first female doctor in America established the first hospital for, staffed, and run by women. The New York Infirmary for Women and Children opened on May 12, 1857, a date which was also the birthday of Blackwell's friend and collaborator, Florence Nightingale, someone you may have heard of. Groundbreaking at the time, the hospital provided free medical care for indigent women and children and offered clinical experience and instruction for women determined to expand their skills as physicians. So one of these days, I will go visit my brother in New York, which I was supposed to do last year. He lives in Greenwich Village, and I'm going to look this up. So Elizabeth Blackwell had this idea of setting up someplace that would provide services for women and also training for women who wanted to be in the medical field. Women would be able to consult female doctors about conditions they felt embarrassed to discuss with men. But all of this was not obvious that Elizabeth would end up here. Elizabeth Blackwell was born in 1821 in Bristol, England. And this is actually a picture of her mother, Hannah Blackwell. I always think it's interesting if you find a picture like this, this means the family had a certain amount of money to pay someone to do a portrait. Elizabeth was the fourth child, but as was common at the time, the brothers on either side of her died as infants. Eventually, there would be nine living children. Her parents were Protestant dissenters from the official Church of England. They valued education, hard work, the natural world, temperance, and the abolition of slavery. But there was an odd thing about that. The father, Samuel, made his living by running a sugar refinery, and everyone knew that sugar was produced by slaves in the Caribbean. Although Samuel and his wife, Hannah, seemed to have a good marriage, none of the five Blackwell girls ever married, an extremely unusual statistic for the time. After a fire at his refinery, business losses, and a series of violent riots in Bristol, Samuel and Hannah decided to leave for the promised land of the New World, America, in 1832, when Elizabeth was 11. So she would have had a British accent. But instead of changing careers, Samuel secured financial backing for another sugar refinery in the New York City area. As a teenager, Elizabeth enjoyed books more than socializing, and here's a picture of her in her youth. She was scornful of the fussy fashions she saw on the street. She envied her brothers who could attend Columbia College, now Columbia University. She wrote, "How I do long for some end to act for, to go on every day in just the same jog-trot manner is very wearisome." And she also wrote, "I wish I could devise some good way of maintaining myself, but the restrictions which confine my dear sex render all my aspirations useless." That is, she wanted some way to support herself as a single woman, and there was nothing. She complained about novels that were all focused on marriage. "I wish some skillful pen would produce an interesting old maid's life." So you could say she went on to live that. Unfortunately, her father Samuel's business once again suffered from a fire and an overall business downturn. Cheap land was available in the West, which at that time meant Ohio. Samuel hoped to grow his own sugar beets in order to produce sugar without slave labor. And this was a dream of some of the other Unitarians and Transcendentalists, though none of them really succeeded. In 1838, when Elizabeth was 17, the family moved to Cincinnati. And here's a picture of Cincinnati around that time. But Samuel became very ill and he died within 3 months after they moved, leaving his wife and nine children a total of $20. Even with inflation, that was not very much money. Brothers Sam and Henry, who were 15 and 13, had to give up their education and go to work. And the girls set up an academy in their home with themselves as teachers. It was around this time that Elizabeth met the ministers, Lyman Beecher and William Henry Channing. And author Janice Nomura writes, "Through Channing, the Blackwells encountered transcendentalism, which chimed with their own ideas regarding the natural goodness of humans. From this time on, Elizabeth considered herself a Unitarian and a Transcendentalist. The academy the sisters started didn't pay enough, so Elizabeth took a riverboat to remote Henderson, Kentucky. She taught 21 girls in a dirt-floored schoolhouse. Her philosophical views found no companionship here. She wrote, "Emerson is a perfect stranger, and Channing, I presume, would produce a universal fainting fit." She lasted only 6 months in this uncongenial environment, but she enjoyed the feeling of earning money for the first time in her life. Then she was back in Cincinnati at the age of 23, hoping to make a living as a writer. It was at this time that a female friend of hers wished that someone like Elizabeth would become a doctor so that she could be treated by someone of her own sex when she had intimate problems. And of course, this was the Victorian era where there was a lot of concern about even mentioning the parts of women's bodies. Elizabeth didn't immediately respond to this appeal to become a doctor. She had no special interest in medicine. If anything, she was repulsed by individual bodies and personalities. Here's what she herself wrote later in life. "I have no turn for benevolences. I feel neither love nor pity for men, for individuals. They may starve, cut each other's throats, or perform any other gentle diversions suitable to the age without any attempt to stop them on my part for their own sakes. But I have boundless love and faith in man, with a capital M, and will work for the race day and night. In other words, I love humanity, its people I can't stand." Elizabeth may have been influenced by reading just at this time Margaret Fuller's book, Woman in the 19th Century, with its call for women to take up every profession, even sea captain. American society was far from ready for this utopia. Elizabeth spoke with and wrote to multiple doctors asking about how she could get a medical education. She constantly received the reply that her dream was impossible. The physical and mental rigors of the field were too much for women. Of course, women during this time were doing all kinds of heavy chores, giving birth in the wilderness and living lives that were quite challenging, but they felt that this would be too hard, and heaven forbid they would be exposed to bodies. And no medical school full of men would admit her. Medicine was following the same trajectory as other sciences. The more it became codified, respected, and well paid, the more it was reserved for men. Women had been healers in traditional societies, and of course, they did almost all the sick care in homes. But trained and paid medicine was the province of men. While teaching in Asheville, North Carolina, and Charleston, South Carolina, Elizabeth studied by dissecting insects and memorizing a skeleton. She continued to discuss her goal with doctors. One said, "The only way to do this would be to go far away, such as Paris, and dress as a man." And indeed, at least one woman did that at that time. Elizabeth was able to do some observation and study under a medical man in Philadelphia who recommended her to Geneva Medical College in upstate New York. The faculty were taken aback by this odd request when she sent in a letter of application. They decided to defer the decision to the students, feeling confident they would reject it. The students took it as a joke, and they almost unanimously voted yes. But it wasn't a joke. A few weeks later, a small, plainly dressed woman entered the classroom, making the whole class sit up and squelching all the usual classroom chatter. There was some unwelcome publicity. Elizabeth was a scandalous figure in the town. Even across the ocean, the English satirical newspaper Punch wrote, "We admire Miss Blackwell, though we have never seen her. She is qualifying herself for that very important duty of a good wife, tending a husband in sickness." When the anatomy professor suggested she should stay home from his lecture the day he talked about male reproductive organs, she calmly reminded him that she was there as a medical student and would attend all the lectures. Medical school at the time was not yet standardized. Courses on anatomy, physiology, surgery, chemistry, and so on were crammed into 16 weeks. Students were required to attend the same lectures 2 years in a row, plus study with a, quote, respectable practitioner in between. The exams were given by the faculty. There was no system of boards or accreditation. There was still a lot of emphasis on expelling bad influences from the body by emetics, laxatives, and leeches. Elizabeth had little social life, but her anatomy professor teamed her with four other students so that they could do dissections away from the larger crowd. She remembered fondly these fellows who she said treated me like an older sister. Between the 2 years of medical class, the students were expected to work or observe in the field, but few doctors or institutions wanted a woman in that role. Elizabeth skillfully lobbied the various board members of Bloxley Almshouse in Philadelphia. As the name suggests, this had been a hospital for the poor and still was, as well as a lunatic asylum. She wrote to her brother, "Within 1 week, a lunatic scalded himself to death. One woman cut her throat. Another fell down a cellar opening and broke both legs and died the following day. Another jumped over the banisters, breaking both ankles." The doctors on site had no interest in helping Elizabeth. She wrote, "When I walked into the wards, they walked out." Fortunately, she found more welcome from the matron, who had long experience. Unfortunately, the experience Elizabeth had overall with women as patients and lowly employees of the hospital, as well as in society, did not engender respect. She wrote to her sister, Emily, "Alas for woman, she seems to me inexpressibly mean," and that's mean in the sense of small, small-minded. She said, "It is not her intellectual inferiority I lament, but the petty, trifling, priest-ridden, gossiping, stupid, inane women of our day. What can we do with them? There are a few strong ones, a sort of exceptional eighth, perhaps. If they could be united, it would be a good beginning. You are one, and sometime or other we must work together, though the way does not seem clear yet." So Elizabeth saw herself in a special minority. While Elizabeth studied at Geneva the very same summer, 1848, in nearby Seneca Falls, the first formal meeting for women's rights adopted the declaration, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." Among other things, it called for greater opportunity in education and employment, and of course for women's suffrage. At a second convention in Rochester, New York, the same year in August, Elizabeth Blackwell was praised for her perseverance as, quote, "a harbinger of the day when woman shall stand forth redeemed and disenthralled." Elizabeth was not flattered. "I don't sympathize with these reforming ladies," she wrote. "I'm very sorry my name was mixed up with the Rochester absurdity. They mistake the matter and make themselves very foolish." And when she received a laudatory letter from one of these foolish ladies, she wrote back that the problem lay not in the tyranny of men, but the weakness of women. She wrote, "Women are feeble, narrow, frivolous at present, ignorant of their own capacities and undeveloped in thought and feeling." So Elizabeth felt that women were not developed enough to be able to vote intelligently. This has echoes of the lean-in idea that women are supposed to change their behavior. And it also brings up the modern controversy about whether social problems lie in individual people or in systems. Elizabeth Blackwell saw the fault in individuals. Other women should do what she had done, break into the male society. She did not see this as a systemic problem. And she seemed to always see herself as something apart. At one time, she called herself a co-worker of God who was there to guide and help lesser mortals. Now, having a lot of confidence and even ego was probably a good thing for her career, but this could have made her a difficult person to live and work with. But she was justified. Elizabeth finished at the top of her class. She wrote that she found the exams slight. She received her diploma in January 1849. She then went to Philadelphia to attend additional lectures and practice dissection. She polished her French because the place to really learn medicine at the time was Paris. Her reception in Paris was mixed and her degree unrecognized, but she was allowed to enter the maternity hospital as a student. So conveniently, of course, the maternity hospital seemed a good fit for a woman. Standards of hygiene and what we today call PPE, or personal protective equipment, were low. Elizabeth was splashed in the eye with contaminated liquid and developed a serious eye infection. With no antibiotics in existence, doctors used such treatments as ammonia, sulfuric acid, and mercury. When her condition didn't improve, she traveled 800 miles to Berlin to take the water cure, This included bundling in wet sheets, bathing, drinking many glasses of water, and taking outside walks. As you might expect, this did nothing to help Elizabeth's eye. She finally returned to Paris and had the eye removed and replaced with a glass prosthetic. Although she had good sight in the remaining eye, the loss meant she couldn't train as a surgeon, something she had hoped for. During this time, Elizabeth encouraged her younger sister, Emily, to follow her into a medical education. Emily was certainly ready for a change, writing in 1851, "I have been teaching for 5 years, and my disgust and hatred of this most detestable occupation has risen to a pitch that is almost unendurable. And life might be so glorious, human nature so lofty, and yet people go on potter in their little contemptible lives and seem to have no more conception of the mysteries around them, of their marvelous existence, than beetles." Elizabeth returned to London, where she was beginning to be accepted. She accompanied doctors on their rounds. And here's a lecture ticket that says to admit Miss Elizabeth Blackwell to lectures on general and morbid anatomy and physiology. She wrote about how in the evening she would go out in society and she was disgusted by the appearance and behavior of society women. Women are so dressed out, don't look like rational beings, and consequently they cannot expect to be treated as such. Apparently she always dressed quite plainly and conservatively. When the youngest Blackwell sister, Barbara, wrote enthusiastically of attending a national women's rights convention in 1850, Elizabeth dismissed the group. "They show great energy, but not a great amount of strong, clear thought." So it's interesting that the youngest sister was sort of a different generation and wanted to embrace women's suffrage. But Elizabeth said she felt the call for women's rights was an anti-man movement. Of course, the only people who had helped her or could have been her teachers or mentors had been men. Of course, there were all those other men who didn't help her, but she felt that other women should do as she had. Throughout her time in Europe, Elizabeth was never paid or subsidized for her study. She felt guilty that a cousin had helped support her. But now she had some influential friends like the newspaper man Horace Greeley. She was able to raise funds, rent space in New York City, and advertise her services. Now, one obstacle to setting up as a woman doctor was that in the past, women who advertised medical services were quacks, abortionists, or both. And here's something from the National Police Gazette. Madame Restel, the female abortionist shown here with a evil-looking familiar or something, something diabolical. New Yorkers, therefore, were rightly skeptical of this new offering. However, in the 13 years that Elizabeth had been in Europe, medical schools for women had been established in Boston and Philadelphia. Remarkable progress. Perhaps inevitably, a backlash followed. Now that women had their own colleges, men thought there was no reason to admit them to the established male ones. Still, a small group of women who had acquired medical knowledge formed around Elizabeth, including her sister Emily. There still were a few places who wanted to hire these women who were trained. Emily gained experience observing at Bellevue Hospital and then attended Rush Medical School in Chicago. They seemed to welcome her, but after the first year, the trustees held an emergency meeting and voted that she could not continue. This decision was denounced at the time by the Chicago Tribune and by the male medical students. But Emily didn't wait for a legal challenge. She moved on to Cleveland Medical College, where she finished with high marks. While Elizabeth opened her dispensary for poor women and children in New York, Emily traveled to Scotland. So here's a picture of Emily around that time. She was mentored by Dr. James Simpson, an expert in midwifery and women's diseases at the prestigious University of Edinburgh. And so here's a ticket that she has for observation, and here's James Simpson. Elizabeth longed for a colleague in New York. She wrote to Emily in the spring of 1854, "This medical solitude is really awful at times. I should thankfully turn to any decent woman to relieve it if I could find one." Well, 3 days later, Elizabeth received a visit from Marie Zakshevska. Oh, here's a caricature and punch that was supposed to be of Emily, who was studying there at the time. Emily is supposed to be, of course, this one on the right with the funny looking outfit and the glasses. And this really doesn't look anything like her as compared to a society lady. So here's Marie, pronounced Zakrzewska, who showed up. She was a Polish woman who had studied medicine in Berlin. She later wrote in her own autobiography, "I have accomplished more than many women of genius and education would have done in my place, for the reason that confidence and faith in their own powers were wanting." So she seemed a kindred soul for Elizabeth. Elizabeth helped Marie get into Cleveland Medical College. Left on her own, Elizabeth closed the dispensary, which had been wearing her down. She bought a house and took in a 6-year-old Irish girl from an orphanage. She said, "I mean to train her up into a valuable domestic if she prove on sufficient trial to have the qualities I give her credit for." The child Catherine Perry called Kitty, though she had been labeled stupid by the orphanage, turned out to be bright, hardworking, and of a sunny disposition. She was told to call her mentor, Dr. Elizabeth. And the first time she was introduced to a male physician, she exclaimed, "How very odd it is to hear a man call doctor." Throughout her life, Kitty retained the odd position of not quite daughter and not quite servant. Well, while Elizabeth and Emily had been traveling and studying, their younger brothers, Henry and Sam, were still in Cincinnati. Now they were running a hardware business. It was there that Henry Blackwell met Lucy Stone, a name you may have heard of. She was already famous as an early female graduate of Oberlin College and a regular lecturer on abolition and women's rights. Henry wrote, "I decidedly prefer her to any lady I ever met." Maybe having such iconoclastic sisters inclined him toward this strong-minded woman. There was one small problem. She didn't believe in marriage, seeing it, rightly at the time, as a form of bondage. Henry sent Lucy books. He helped her arrange speaking tours and even made a feminist speech himself at the 4th National Women's Rights Convention. But here's how he really won her heart. In 1854, Henry was alerted to a Southern family passing through Cincinnati by train. He approached the family's enslaved girl, who was about 9 or 10 years old. He asked her if she wanted to be free. And when she said yes, he forcibly removed her from the train. This endeared him to Lucy Stone. They arranged to be married, but Henry was to read at the ceremony a public protest against the existing laws denying married women their rights. Of course, his sister, Elizabeth, objected to this public airing of private views as a vulgar vanity. But Henry went ahead with his statement, as well as omitting the word obey from the ceremony. Lucy introduced her into her new family, her friend from Oberlin, Antoinette Brown, the first woman to preach at a congregational church. Within the year, Elizabeth's brother Sam married Antoinette, also called Nettie. The next year, Henry, Sam, their wives, and their mother all moved into the big house Elizabeth owned in New York City. Marie Zakrzewska, known to all as Dr. Zach, was there, along with Elizabeth's companion, Kitty. And in 1856, Nettie gave birth in the house to Florence, named for another medical woman, Florence Nightingale. And the same month, Emily returned from Europe. The New York Infirmary for Indigent Women and Children opened in 1857 in a brick building, which had once been the home of the Roosevelt family. Henry Ward Beecher was the keynote speaker. 2 months later, the New York Times ran a laudatory article called "What the Lady Doctors Are Doing." They noted the home-like atmosphere, as fresh and clean as if just swept by the proverbial new broom. The nursing care was assumed to be good, quote, "if one may judge from the physiognomy of the motherly looking dames who have charge." So I'm not sure the New York Times was reviewing it for its medical qualities. And not everyone was sure about this. This woman had newfangled ideas about hygiene. And when one woman died in the maternity ward, nefarious rumors spread. More than once, mobs gathered outside the hospital. So even before the age of Twitter and Facebook, people were able to spread rumors and show up to express their displeasure. There were still many who refused to accept female doctors. Or if they allowed that such a thing could be helpful to the poor, they declined to accept those doctors into their own drawing rooms. Elizabeth did have a few backers, for example, Lady Byron, widow of the infamous poet. Elizabeth wrote to her in 1857, "Very few understand the soul of this work or the absolute necessity which lies upon me to live out the ideal life to the utmost extent of my power. My work is undoubtedly for the few and is necessarily difficult of appreciation to the mass, very slow in gaining their esteem. At least she said she had some allies. My sister is a noble helper, and we shall stand, I trust, shoulder to shoulder through many years of active service." But with Emily and Marie in place, Elizabeth decided to make one more voyage to England with 10-year-old Kitty as her companion. But she had some strange ideas about how to treat this 10-year-old. She dispatched Kitty to her brother's home and thence to a boarding school. Kitty was miserable, alone in a new culture, suffering the common English school fates of bullying and chilblains. She wrote letters begging Elizabeth to rescue her, but the school never mailed them. Finally, the resourceful Kitty mailed one in town during a school outing, and Elizabeth responded. However, Elizabeth had moved on to Paris, and Kitty was sent alone, 10 years old, by train, ferry, and another train with just an address in her pocket. And of course, she didn't speak French. At the Paris train station, no one was there to meet her. It turned out Elizabeth had gone to the wrong station. The officials put Kitty in a carriage. She later recalled, "Having read, small as I was, too much about the revolution, I expected to be carted off to prison or the guillotine." Luckily, Elizabeth, arriving at the correct station, recognized Kitty's trunk on the back of the cab. Elizabeth's main occupation in Paris was giving a series of lectures on women's health for Parisian ladies. She gave a remarkably frank talk on women's reproductive organs. On her return to New York, plans for a larger hospital that would include a clinic and living space were interrupted by the outbreak of the Civil War. The Blackwell sisters were, of course, enthusiastic union supporters. They advertised a meeting at the Cooper Institute's Great Hall. Oh, this is the report of the infirmary. There we go. This was a meeting to organize volunteers and donations to help in the Civil War. Between 2,000 and 3,000 women attended. While many of the women would work in collecting supplies, rolling bandages, and knitting socks, Elizabeth was named chair of the registration committee, tasked with recruiting women for more direct medical work. From this meeting was born the most important civilian organization of the Civil War, the Sanitary Commission, which you may have heard of. However, the leaders excluded from any war work the Blackwell's infirmary and any public leadership by the Blackwells. The fear was that their reputation would sully the good name of the new organization. Elizabeth wrote, "Of course, as it is essential to open the hospitals to nurses, we kept in the background. Had there been any power to support us, we would have fought for our true place, but there was none." While the Sanitary Commission moved on to Washington, D.C., the sisters in New York, without recognition, trained at least 100 nurses for war work. Throughout these years, the Blackwell sisters looked askance at the new women's medical colleges. Their goal was to have women admitted to the existing men's colleges. The quality of learning in the female graduates they took on at their clinic didn't impress them. But when the third U.S. medical school for women opened right in New York City, the sisters decided they needed to join the movement to assure education at the level they expected. In December 1863, Elizabeth had announced to her staff, "We believe the time has come to form a really good school of medicine for women," but then the war subsumed all of their interests. The Women's Medical College of the New York Infirmary didn't open until 1868. Theirs was the first of the women's institutions, and maybe of all such colleges, to offer a 3-year curriculum that built from year to year without repetition. They were also the first to offer a course on hygiene taught by Emily. And here's some pictures of Elizabeth and Emily in the later years. Now much of Elizabeth's time was devoted to administration and fundraising, which were not her favorite endeavors. Also, as Emily became more confident and experienced, Elizabeth was no longer the undisputed leader, which led to some conflicts. Elizabeth decided to travel back to England. She rejoiced in her freedom from the everyday concerns of the hospital, writing, "I would sink the whole thing in the bottom of the Sound rather than come back to it." In England, Elizabeth was the first woman to be placed on the British Medical Register. In her last 20 years, Elizabeth remained in England, where she expanded her interest in hygiene to campaigns against prostitution and in favor of chastity. This was partly in response to the scourge at the time of syphilis. She also campaigned against vaccination based on an experience where one child had died, and she campaigned against vivisection, that is, experimentation on animals. She, like many other prominent thinkers of the time, was interested in the developing science of eugenics and breeding. So some of these ideas are not favored by us today. And like many in the second half of the 19th century, she developed an active interest in spiritualism. The lines around the interests of science at the time were still quite fluid. Here's a picture of her later in life with Kitty, who stayed with her. Emily continued to run the Women's Medical College until 1899, at which time women were beginning to take their place as students in men's institutions like Johns Hopkins and Cornell. Elizabeth and Emily died within months of each other in 1910. Elizabeth is buried in Scotland, a place she had loved in her travels. Janice Nimura ends her biography this way. In 1910, when the Blackwell sisters died, there were more than 9,000 women doctors in the United States, about 6% of all physicians. Today, 35% of physicians and slightly more than half of all medical students are female. Now, as we know, this does not mean that women always have equal opportunities for everything in science, but this was still a remarkable achievement. So I will turn this off here. And we do have time for some comments or questions, and I'll put that information in the chat about the book. And let's see, Renee, did you want to call on people or do you want me to?
You can call on people. I'll point people out if you don't see people's hands.
Let me get the gallery. Rachel, yes, I wondered, Rachel, if you knew anything about when medical schools started actually having that three-year curriculum and if they were the first.
Yeah, I'm not the right person to answer. I'm not a great historian of medicine. I was just going to share my ninth grade experience in my career class. Some of you may have heard this story before of me expressing interest in being a doctor and having my male careers teacher in ninth grade say, "Why don't you think about nursing?" So we're not that far along in our path. Of course, that was, you know, when I was 14, so that's a long time ago. But things are slow and changing. There's lots of change all the time, but, you know, it's still our current day where there's lots of prejudices. And it's not just prejudices against women being doctors, but I see how men are treated as nurses or as stay-at-home dads. You know, we have our fixed ideas about gender that are very entrenched, and it's just, you know, we got to just keep pushing on the edge there.
Yeah, and then there are stories from today of doctors who are Black or Latino being assumed to be orderlies when they come into the room. Oh, Barb.
I was wondering, I'm thinking of the story of the woman physician who worked in the Civil War, who was a universalist, and I cannot think of her name, but maybe it'll come to you, who wore men's clothing because she thought women's clothing was just terrible and impractical. And that was illegal at the time. And so finally it took an act of Congress to allow her to dress as a man. And of course,
Clara Barton was also active, but she did not change her style of dress particularly. But
right. Yeah. She's about the only person I've heard of who fits that bill. And I, like I said, her name just escapes me at the moment. I just know she's a universalist.
And actually it seemed to be sort of random how Elizabeth picked medicine, and that she probably could have done the same thing in other fields if she had been pointed in that direction.
Yeah, I can't remember where this other woman got her training either, but clearly she was a contemporary since she was active in the Civil War. Must have been just a bit after Elizabeth.
I'll have to look that up. You could send that out to Prairie News Reviews. Any other questions or comments? Wait, Bob, did you have something there? Oh, not hearing you. Oh, are you muted there? We can't hear you, Bob.
You have to unmute yourself.
Okay.
I thought we were still unmuted. But my question, Robin, was about an illustrated children's book about Elizabeth Blackwell. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, well, there actually are several. And I used one when I did the sock service, which Bob was always there to record. There was a children's book. It's just I had returned it to the library and thought it might be easier to just do one that we could play. But yes, there actually seem to be more children's biographies of Elizabeth Blackwell than there are of, adult biographies of her. So where did that come from? Rachel's showing us something there.
This one, which is backwards, I think, in the camera.
No, that's right.
Challenge to Become a Doctor, the Story of Elizabeth Blackwell, School of Medicine, No Women Admitted. And this also, it's not really a children's book exactly. It's maybe middle school years, but it has a lot of really nice pictures in it. And if any of you are interested, I'd be happy to loan it out since pretty soon I'll be in Madison and can give things out to people again. So, but this is a fun book, which my grandfather gave me when I was interested in becoming a doctor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there are several children's picture books that talk about her experience. And
this ancient thing was put out by what was called the Feminist Press, 1971.
Oh, okay. Eileen?
That's so ancient.
I found it very contradictory that you shared that she was interested in medicine, but not in people. That seems so, she worked so hard to get her medical training, and it sounded as if it was in order, number one, to make a living in some way that she felt was important for herself, and went to such great lengths for that, and then didn't really enjoy the part of working with people. She ended up going into teaching, which was still working with people, but or setting up things, more administrative, it seemed like. What else did you find in the book about that?
Well, this idea that she really wanted to be a surgeon kind of makes sense, because the surgeons don't have to spend a lot of time chatting. The person is out, right? Thanks to Martin and some of the others. Even at that time, that was pretty primitive. I think they were maybe using ether, but maybe not whiskey in the Civil War to anesthetize people. But you didn't have to have a lot of bedside manner for that. I sometimes wonder about these brilliant people, whether today we would say she was somewhere on the autism spectrum, because she seemed to be extremely smart and, you know, those things she was interested in, and not that interested in social life and dealing with the other people. Or many geniuses are not the easiest person to live with. And then this contradiction about how she felt, since she made it in a man's world, other people should do, even though it certainly took quite a lot for her to do that. And really, she only was admitted to that medical school because the students thought it was a joke. But apparently the time was somewhat ripe because of the fact that these other schools were established. And then I think with the Civil War, there was a lot more sense. And then Florence Nightingale was doing similar work in Britain. At one time, the nurses were really more like charwomen who were sort of supposed to be cleaning up to the low standards they had at the time and performing, maybe taking out bedpans and this sort of thing, rather than actually having medical knowledge. Do we have other questions or comments? And if not, we could always chat later. And for our, just a second here. Our closing words. If society will not admit of women's redevelopment, then society must be remodeled. And we have some closing music.
All right, so this is, I'll share the screen. Oh, I have to exit out the other one. Okay, I have to get to the other one. So it's a pop song and the lyrics are actually gonna be on the screen. So if you have heard the song on the radio, you can go ahead and sing along. It seemed like a upbeat, fun song for us to end this on. So I'm just gonna stop.